The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show.
On Relevant Radio.
AOC, at, again, a dinner that costs $35,000 a head, shows up in a dress that reads Tax the Rich. Oh, by the way, she drives a Tesla. Okay, so please pardon me if you look a little hypocritical to me. And the worst of it was no mask, right on top of other people. AOC, Bill de Blasio, Carolyn Maloney, these people are the ones who imposed mandatory masks on my kids and yours, okay? So kids like mine are sitting in class all day long, 8 to 9 hours with masks on because of politicians like this. AOC can be there, Mayor de Blasio can be there without their masks. Hobnobbing, rubbing elbows, sitting at dinner tables. You know what the New York City kids have to do? They have to sit outside, have their lunches 6 feet apart while they sit on the ground. They have to wear masks outside if they're not 6 feet apart, and in New York, even if they are 6 feet apart. That's how the kids are living. But these people can go to the Met Gala and live it up large because it makes them feel good about themselves.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
You might recognize that voice. That was Megyn Kelly getting passionate about the issue. Good afternoon. I'm Drew Mariani. Thank you for joining me. If you're just getting tuned in, I'm joined this afternoon by Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, and we are exploring the latest when it comes to natural immunity and COVID. And Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, of course, he teaches at the Center for Primary Care and Outcomes Research at Stanford University School of Medicine. If you're on hold, I'll do my best to get you on the air. I promise you that. And if you want to try to get through, you're more than welcome to join the conversation. There's a lot of news that is coming, you know, before all of us every day. You know, Alaska once had the highest vaccination rate. Now it is in a COVID-19 crisis. We are seeing the talk of vaccinating kids that are now 5 years of age and older. So do those kids need it? And what about ivermectin and HCQ and, you know, some of these other drugs? How effective are they in the fight against COVID-19? Also, if you've had natural immunity, this is the big question. This is what we want to address. We'll do it right at the top here. If you've had COVID and you have recovered, you have natural immunity. How long does it last? And do you need a vaccine? I think that's a huge question for millions of Americans. And doctor, let's start with that one. What's the word? Like I said, my daughter, who's 23 years old, she's had COVID, and she's thinking about getting a vaccination. I said, well, wait a minute. You know, you may have natural immunity. You may not need it. Give me your thought on that, if you could.
If you had COVID and recovered, you have pretty long-lasting, durable immunity. So, like I said earlier in the show, 0.3% of people who had COVID and recovered within a year, only 0.3% are actually reinfected, and it tends to be much, much milder if you are reinfected in two major studies that were recently released. Okay, should you get the vaccine if you've already had COVID and recovered? So first, let me just say it's safe to do it. So the large trials that looked at this by Pfizer and others, looked to see whether giving the vaccine to people who already had recovered, whether it was safe, and they determined it was safe. On the other hand, there isn't very good evidence that you have long-lasting boosting of your immunity from natural infection if you get this. And for a short time, you get a boost in antibodies if you get the vaccine after you've recovered. And so you are probably more protected against some reinfections, but to my mind, it's not firmly established. That's a much smaller benefit. And let me put it in a broader global context. Mm-hmm. There's still millions of people worldwide, older people who are at very high risk from COVID disease that do not have access to vaccines. We should be sending those doses to the older population around the world, rather than talking about boosters and talking about which only provide a small improvement if any. I mean, there really isn't good data or doses for people who've already recovered.
All right, let's thank you, doctor. Great answer. We'll go to the phones, and my gratitude to everyone who's so patiently waiting. Dr. Antonio is listening in Providence, Rhode Island. He's got a question and wants to join the conversation.
Yeah. Hi, doctor. Hi, Drew. Listen. You know, my concern is that the slogan for physicians for thousands of years has been, you know, primum non vultere, first do no harm. And I'm concerned that exposing kids to the vaccine, it's not justified medically, particularly when the average age of death of a COVID victim is 74 years old. So, I mean, let's vaccinate the elderly. I had COVID in March of 2020, really knocked me down. And, I had to fall asleep by the sleep sitting up in bed for three nights in a row. But the thing is, I get over it. And listen, just a low-tech thing, Drew. You don't know the numbers to believe because, right. I mean, 7,500 people approximately die every day in the United States.
Right.
And they're not telling us that. They're not reminding us that, 2.7 million people die in the United States every year. And they're not telling us exactly how many, what the morbidity is, but what the actual morbidity and mortality from pure COVID is.
Yep.
Because, of course, they're trying to sell us the vaccine and they're trying to, whatever the political motivations were to squash the economy or
let me interrupt you for a second there.
The presidential election, whatever. These are all factors.
Doctor, I want your take on something. Let me just jump in on that point because I'm really glad that you called on this point. I want your theory behind this. I actually asked my wife this, and it was a question that wasn't answered. Over the weekend, I saw a program. Cheryl Atkinson did a piece. She does a program called Full Measure. And just by chance, I normally don't get a chance to watch it, I stumbled across it. And she did a piece. I mean, the big number that came out last week, 1 in 500 deaths in the nation, supposedly from COVID. I'm just stunned by that number. I think that's 1 in 500 as a result of COVID, really? I think of how many people I know that have gotten in and survived. I do know people who've gone, God has called home through it. But she went to a small town that had very low COVID rates. And then when they started to report them, one was a murder-suicide. She went to the coroner and said, why was this put down as COVID when clearly it was a murder-suicide? People who have been in car accidents, people who have committed suicide, people who have had heart attacks, they're all being attributed to as COVID-19 deaths. And Dr. Bhattacharya, Dr. Antonio, I'd love to hear both of your takes on it. I mean, what's the motive behind that? Who does it benefit?
Drew, one last point. Listen, I went very, very low tech. I've been to five cemeteries, and I talked to men who have been digging graves for 30 years, and they told me that the numbers are the same. They said in March and April of 2020, they saw a slight increase, but generally the numbers have been the same, and I don't know why people haven't been interviewing the funeral directors associations and the grave diggers, the cemetery workers, because those people have real numbers.
Yeah. That's a great point, Doctor. Hey, Doctor, thank you. I want to put Dr. Bhattacharya into the conversation as well. Doctor, you heard Dr. Antonio there. And I'd like maybe you to address this. I mean, what's the end goal? It almost seems like there's an agenda to vaccinate the entire nation by falsifying claims of death in the nation. I don't know why you would do that. And if that is indeed the case, then it would give every American pause. Why do you want to inject me so badly? What's in the vaccination? 1 in 500 deaths in the nation, supposedly from COVID. Dr. Antonio saying, hey, not so. Talk to the funeral association. You'll get different numbers. Your thoughts on it, Dr. J.
Okay, so, I mean, something like 650,000 people have been attributed to die from COVID. Dr. Antonio is right. There's about 3 million people that die a year. So in the United States, I mean, it is a severe disease for older people, but it's not the only severe disease, and it's not the only threat in public health that people face. There's cancer, there's heart disease, there's a whole host of other threats to human health. By focusing so much on a single disease, we've actually harmed health in other dimensions. People actually skipped cancer screening. People actually skipped cancer treatment because they were scared of COVID last year. Women are going to have stage 4 breast cancer that should have been picked up earlier in earlier stages if they'd only been screened last year. Same thing with colon cancer and other cancers. Heart disease treatment, diabetes management, you name it. We basically reorganized healthcare around one single disease instead of remembering that people face a very, very wide range of threats to their health. So I completely agree with Dr. Antonio that we need to put COVID in context. There have been a couple of studies actually that are interesting on over diagnosis of COVID. So for instance, there was a death certificate review in Santa Clara County where I live that found that there is 25% overcounting of COVID cases. And hospitals actually have an incentive to diagnose COVID because they get in Medicare patients, older patients, they get a 20% bump in their payment, or at least that was the policy for quite a long time, if they're treating COVID patients. So there's some incentives to diagnose COVID. So I do think the broader problem is helping the public understand where COVID fits on the range of risks in their lives. And for most of the population, it's not actually a very significant risk. It's only for the older population that's really that where it proposes really severe threat of disease or death, I mean. And for that population and for and others who are nervous about it, they can take the vaccine.
Right.
Do you need universal vaccination? Well, the question is for what? The vaccine, because it does not stop disease from spreading after a few short months, means that it cannot be used as a way to achieve herd immunity. That is actually something that, Dr. Fauci got wrong and the public health authorities got wrong. It will not stop the disease from spreading. I'll give you an example. In Iceland, a very large fraction of their population, adult population, was vaccinated, and nevertheless, there was an enormous surge in cases. The people that were vaccinated were protected against severe disease, and right. So they had much lower deaths than they would have otherwise had. This disease is here to stay. Every person on the face of the earth will face this disease at some point in their life.
Wow. I should have you repeat that again. You're saying every person on the face of the earth will face this at one point in their life, COVID-19.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's not, we have no technology to get rid of this disease. To tell people that we have, that we can, if we just lock down hard enough or if we just comply hard enough or do all these things, that's not true. The only question is, how do you get protected against the disease if you were to get it? And we have great tools now, actually, the vaccine being one. But we also have some treatments. Maybe we have some chance to talk about them that I think are actually quite effective and well established. I mean, it's not a disease to fear anymore. I think that's the message I want to get to people.
No, please, doctor. I don't mean to step on you. Please go right ahead.
Yeah, I think this is a disease that is now much more manageable than it was in 2020. And I think the public health folks who are still in their alarm mode, trying to make people scared, I think are doing the public a major disservice. The vaccines are good, especially for older people, against protecting against severe disease. You're much less likely to die or get hospitalized if you get it. At the same time, if you do get it, there are treatments like the monoclonal antibodies that will reduce the likelihood of hospitalization by 70% if you get it within the first 5 days of treatment. It's approved by the FDA. Everyone agrees with it. Governor DeSantis in Florida made it so that you can get you just call and you get a strike team that'll come to your house and give it to you. I wish every governor would do that. So there's vitamin D, which is established as a sort of helps protect against if you do get severe disease. There are drugs like dexamethasone to reduce the immune overreaction. There's a lot more we know about how to manage the disease than we did in March of 2020, and we should not be telling the public acting as if we've learned nothing. We should be, in many ways, reassuring the public about this.
Yeah, our news director just texted me. She asked if you could state the fact again about being less likely to get COVID from naturally immune people versus those who've been vaccinated. Can you restate that for those who may have missed that before the top of the hour? Because that was a bombshell statement you made.
Yeah, so the vaccine, after a few short months, no longer protects against disease spread. In other words, a vaccinated individual can both get the disease and spread the disease. And especially after 5 months, there's a Qatari study out of Qatar that shows this. You basically have the same risk of spreading, getting infected after if you're vaccinated or not. You still have very strong protection against severe disease. So if you get infected, you're much less likely to die. So the vaccine is still worthwhile. But think about what that means. That means if I'm in a room of just people who've just been vaccinated, nothing else, they never got the disease before, I can still get the disease from them. Whereas if I'm in a room of people who have recovered from the disease and have natural immunity, I'm actually less likely to be able to get the disease from them than in a room filled with just vaccinated people.
Mm-hmm. All right. My producer, Maggie, also just received an email or a text, I think, from one of our contributors to this program as well, Dr. Meg Meeker, as a great physician and has written a number of books. What's she saying? What's she asking, Maggie?
She said she wished she could call in, but she wants to thank everyone that's been on the show talking about this issue. She said, here's the point I want to make. There is no other vaccine that we give to a person simply to help make someone else, the common good, in other words, better. We're asking people to take the risk of the vaccine for another person. Is that ethical? We would never do that for flu, etc. Is it fair for one person to take the risk of them getting the vaccine just to help another person? And as far as packing ICUs, that really isn't an issue anymore, is what she's saying.
That's a really good...
You're still here. Yeah, go right ahead.
Yeah, so I think the key thing there is that the vaccine, many vaccines do have that effect, both of protecting the person vaccinated and also protecting others. This vaccine, after a few short months, only protects you. It does not protect others.
Right.
Because you no longer blocks infection. And I agree with the comment. It's not ethical to ask people to take a vaccine that only protects others, doesn't protect you.
Right.
The vaccine should, to be ethical, should protect you, and as a byproduct, protect others. It's not for young kids. It's not at all clear that the vaccine protects them. It doesn't actually protect them against severe disease, because young kids are very, 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 very unlikely to get severe outcomes from COVID. Right. More children die of the flu than die of COVID. More children die of the flu than COVID. It's not so. Any bit of adverse reactions for children would cut against giving the vaccine to children. Whereas for young, as I said, for older people, the calculus is a little bit different. Older people, COVID severe disease, you're protecting against that. That's a really good thing.
Right.
So that's why the vaccine is worthwhile, even if there's possibility of some side effects.
If you're just joining us, Dr. Jay Bhattacharya is my guest today. We're taking a look at all things COVID, some of the latest developments. And I just received an email from somebody who says, Dr. Bhattacharya is missing the point. People who have proper preventative care, vitamin D, C, zinc, plus treatments with ivermectin or butazonide or Zithromax, she's saying, work. People are not dying at exceedingly high rates. Look at the stats on those who lived through it. They've received proper treatment early, and they're not getting put on a ventilator. Maybe you can address that. And let me bring Catherine in before you address that, because she's got a similar comment here. I think she's asking about why we're not hearing more about treatments for this. Catherine in Bernie, Texas, thanks for joining the conversation. You're on the air.
Thank you. I have to say that I'm very glad to hear you speaking about the things that I'm concerned about, because you don't often hear anybody say anything except get the vaccine, get the vaccine, get the vaccine. And I don't think that's necessary. I think in some ways it's harmful. And personally speaking, just as a side note, I have O negative blood, and I did get the COVID. However, I had been on hydroxychloroquine for several months, along with zinc, D, and C. And 5 days after I was diagnosed, I got monoclonal antibodies, and I was sick basically one day and then dragged out for a few days, and that was it. And I just would want more and more people to know, just like you just read someone's text, there are things to do besides the vaccine, which I think is harmful in some ways, and I would not want it for myself or anybody in my family.
Right.
So, but I am really happy to hear you speaking about these things.
Well, thank you, Catherine. I'm going to let Dr. Bhattacharya respond, too, because she says, hey, what about the treatments that are out there? You heard the email that came in. A lot of people taking a more natural, non-vaccinated approach to fighting COVID, Doc. Your thoughts?
Kevin, thanks. I'm glad for your comment, and glad you had such a mild case, and I'm glad you got early treatment. Let me just say, I think broadly speaking, I entirely agree. As I was saying earlier, there are a number of treatments that are well documented to be effective, especially monoclonal antibodies, a 70% reduction in hospitalization risk if you get it within the first 5 days of symptoms, and vitamin D I think is great. Zinc is great. There is a lot of controversy in the medical literature about ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, and fluvoxamine, some others. I'll just say this. I don't know if they work. There's a lot of doctors who think they work and a lot of doctors who don't think they work. What should have happened by now, 18 months or 19 months into the pandemic, is we should have had very high-quality scientific evaluation of these drugs using randomized trials or some such technology. The fact that we haven't is actually a major public health failure. It's a scandal in some sense that we have not had a resolution to these questions, that there still remains a uncertainty in the scientific community and medical community about whether these are effective. I would not fault people for trying these drugs out. I can't tell you for certain that they work because the scientific literature has not resolved it.
All right. Kevin's listening in Chicago. Kevin, thanks for waiting so long. Good afternoon.
Hey, Drew. Hi, doctor. Hi. You mentioned that you got sick 6 months, you got reinfected. I imagine you got the Delta. And your symptoms were pretty decent. Would you say that antibody-dependent enhancement may have had something to do with it, ADE, where apparently the replication is increased because of the vaccine?
Wow.
Yeah, so that's a good question. So let me describe the what antibody-dependent enhancement is and how it works and whether it's likely going on here or not. So for some vaccines, but probably most famously for dengue fever vaccine, there was an experience where you get the vaccine, and the antibodies that are produced in effect make the disease worse when you're exposed to the agent, when you're exposed to the virus, because they don't completely neutralize the virus. They create an immune overreaction that actually makes getting sick worse. It's kind of like a negative vaccine, right? The evidence that I've seen does not indicate that that's happening with this virus. The vaccine does not make disease worse. It makes disease less mild. I'm sorry, less severe. You're less likely to die, less likely to be hospitalized if you're infected. What they're saying is that
after 6 months, and you know the antibodies are waning in someone who's gotten the vaccine, that's when ADE can happen. And I think there was some Israeli study that I was reading about that. So what happens is the vaccine actually helps replicate the Delta if you got the earlier vaccine. So ADE is happening in some cases.
I think if you look at the Israeli data, what you're seeing is that the vaccine does not stop the disease from spreading. After five, six months, the vaccine stops being able to protect you against being infected. You can, therefore, that means you can get sick, even though I was vaccinated. However, the evidence is also strong that even after 6 months, certainly 6 months, you are still very strongly protected against severe disease. You are still strongly protected against getting hospitalized from dying from this if you've been vaccinated. Things can change as you keep tracking over time, and I'll keep reading the literature. But from what I've seen, I'm not seeing evidence that it's an ADE kind of situation where it would actually make the disease worse. The disease is actually milder if you've been vaccinated, even after 6 months. What's different and interesting is that the vaccine does not protect you against getting infected. You can get infected even though you've been vaccinated, which is not our normal experience with vaccines that we have a lot of good experience with. If you get the measles vaccine, you're protected against measles for a very, very, very long time, probably a lifetime. Right. That's the difference between, that's why like we think about vaccines as producing that kind of sterilizing immunity where you can't even get infected at all. This one, I think the primary function is to reduce the severity of the disease if you were to get it, rather than protecting you against getting it altogether. After a few months, it no longer protects you against that.
All right, doctor, we only have a few minutes. Let's grab a few more calls. Kevin, thank you for your call. Mary is listening in Illinois. Mary, good afternoon.
Hi there. My question is, thank you for letting me call in. But anyway, my question was, why is Dr. Fauci and the government not talking about the natural immunity versus vaccination? They seem to suppress any questions about it or any studies that might have come out. You know, they kind of disappear from the internet after a day or so. And then even Jen Psaki herself was asked in a news conference or what have you a couple of weeks ago, and she was asked about studies in regards to the natural immunity. And she goes, oh, we haven't looked into that yet.
Right.
Like what?
Yeah, it is strange. And doctor, I don't know whether you can answer that or not, but it goes into the conversation we had earlier with Dr. Antonio as well. And Cheryl Atkinson's report on, you know, all these deaths that are being reported and attributed to COVID. And then you have figures like Fauci and even the White House spokesperson that aren't addressing natural immunity. It brings us back to that. Is it a fear that people will say, oh, I think I might have had it, therefore I'm not going to get vaccinated, and they just want to make sure everybody's vaccinated? What's your thought?
I think that's what it is, right? They're trying to essentially, by denying basic scientific facts, they are essentially trying to manipulate the public. They're trying to, they think of it as a noble lie. If I just tell the noble lie, so I can get people to get, I think a better communication strategy is to just be honest with the public. Yeah, tell people, here's what we know, here's what we don't know, and then let people decide based on the position they're in, rather than trying to force them or manipulate them, which I think backfires every time. A lot of the distrust you're hearing and the calls I've heard over the discussion around natural immunity and so forth has come because the people like Dr. Fauci have done everything they can to try to. I think that he's really harmed public health. I think he's harmed the trust that people may have in public health because he's emphasized things that he wants to emphasize. He's de-emphasized or even denied things that are clearly true in the scientific literature, and he's not helped put it up all in the service of trying to get everybody vaccinated. Because maybe he thinks that's the only way to stop the disease from spreading, but I don't think that that's actually true.
Right.
The better approach is to be honest with people about what the scientific literature is saying, what we know, what we don't know, and then like, people have to make up their minds based on. We live in a world filled with uncertainties.
I know,
I think that honesty is the best policy.
The truth will set you free, right? Let me sneak one other call in here, doctor. I know we're pressed for time with you. Martha's listening in Wisconsin. Hi, Martha. Good afternoon.
Hi, doctor. Thank you for taking my call. Two quick questions. I have heard Dr. McCullough, who seems to be kind of the preeminent doctor who led treatment for COVID early on, say that when you have had COVID, one and done, you have 100% immunity for life. When people asked him, well, what about people who they say have tested positive twice, he said, I think what's probably gone on there is one of those times the PCR test gave a false positive, because that test has not been highly accurate, and I'm kind of curious your thoughts on that.
Sure. So Dr. McCullough, first of all, has done fantastic work on early treatment. He's a real pioneer and been very, very brave, and he's taken a lot of flack for it. On reinfection, I think the rate is about 0.3% at 1 year. That doesn't mean that you have protection for life. We don't know the answer to that because it hasn't been, you know, we only had the disease around for 19 months. The other coronaviruses, you know, COVID is, SARS-CoV-2 is a coronavirus. The other coronaviruses do not, when you get infected, you don't get protection for life, but you do get like several years of protection. The other coronaviruses are common cold viruses. You probably got infected when you were young, a little kid. You came with daycare, you came home with the sniffles, relatively mild. And then when you got reinfected, again, it was relatively mild, and you keep getting reinfected every 3 or 4 years with those other coronaviruses, the common cold viruses. This virus, I think, is headed in that direction. The main problem with this virus is that if you get infected for the first time in your life when you're old, then you face severe disease. If you get infected for the first time in your life as a young kid, while you get protection, and presumably, I think, quite long-lasting protection, if not lifelong, but when you get reinfected, it'll be milder. This, I think, virus will eventually become the another circulating coronavirus that causes common cold.
Yeah. Well, doctor, I have to leave it right there. I am so grateful for your time, and you give me a lot of it today. Thank you for being here, and I look forward to the next conversation. We'll continue to monitor all that's unfolding and try to bring some clarity and truth to it. Have a wonderful day, doc.
Thank you, Drew.
Thank you. That's Dr. Jay Bhattacharya. He teaches at the Center for Primary Care and Outcomes Research at Stanford University School of Medicine. Stay with me. A short pause, and I'll be back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
It is really a war against the child, a direct killing of the innocent child, murder by the mother herself. And if we accept that the mother can kill even her own child, how can we tell other people not to kill one another? How do we persuade a woman not to have an abortion? As always, we must pursue her with love, and we remind ourselves that love means to be willing to give until it hurts. Jesus gave even his life to love us. So the mother who is thinking of abortion should be helped to love, that is, to give until it hurts her plans, her free time, to respect the life of her child. For the child is the greatest gift of God to the family, because it has been created to love and to be loved.
Wow, those are such anointed and such powerful words from what would be a future saint, a living saint, really, the great Saint Mother Teresa of Calcutta. That was 1993, and I think it was a national prayer breakfast she made that address. Haunting words. Look, we're living in a special time. You and I have been chosen to live at this particular moment in history, and there's so much unfolding, not only in our nation, but in our courts. The Supreme Court has set December 1st as a date when they're going to hear the oral arguments in a very important case, the Dobbs versus Jackson's Women Health Organization, which is being referred to as the Dobbs case. You'll hear more of that, I'm sure, in the days ahead. And if you're not familiar with it, let me just give you a quick snapshot of what it's all about so you're in the know. This is the case from Mississippi where the law is that no abortions can take place after 15 weeks. It's also the case that most analysts say could be the case that overturns Roe v. Wade. It could overturn nearly 50 years of abortion madness in our country. This is the case. But as you heard in the news headlines at the very beginning of today's broadcast, I addressed this, that there's a bill right now in Congress. It's called the Women's Health Protection Act. And do your research on this. I mean, be aware of what this is all about, okay? You talk about nefarious, right? This would, in essence, make Roe the law of the land. And it would stop all state laws on it. We are in a battle today, unlike any other time. A battle for life and a battle against death. That's really what this is about. I think it's a battle of good versus evil. I really do. There's going to be a vote on that Women's Health Reproductive Act. And you ought to call your elected officials and say, yo, I want you to represent my position on life. That vote's taking place Friday in the House. People are urging, friends, families, churches, everyone to get the word out and let the representatives know that they oppose what is an absolutely really radical, I call it an evil bill. That's what it is. It's downright evil. I'll call for what it is. The Supreme Court's coming under pressure, though, in this Dobbs case. More than 500 female athletes. I'll be honest with you. I saw the story, and it irritated me. You know, who's the female soccer player? Rapinoe, I think is her name. I mean, she was Rapinoe. Rapinoe's her name. She was one of these 500 athletes who joined onto an amicus brief. It was filed earlier this week, urging the court not to overturn Roe. They got to keep it, you know, they got to keep it enshrined. We have to keep a woman's right to do this, you know. And what they did, these 500 athletes, I don't know why their voice is any more important than anybody else's. They cited the importance of what they call, quote, bodily integrity and decisional autonomy, which I love words. That sounds pretty clean and antiseptic, right? You've got to, you know, we got to protect bodily integrity and decisional autonomy. Decisional autonomy. We need to defend reproductive justice. I mean, look at these words. Why don't you call it for what it really is? Why do you have to whitewash it, huh? Why do you have to whitewash the tomb? What you're embracing is death. It's decay. It's corrupt. It's evil. You can whitewash it with any fancy words you want, but that's really what it is. We need to, you know, uphold the bodily integrity, decisional autonomy for how abortions, you know. They think that this... They think this helps women's sports. That's what they think. And it's sad. Apparently a lot of women athletes have sacrificed their children in order to play these sports, in order to keep and advance their careers. And my heart goes out to them because they're mistaken. Clearly they're wounded. Clearly they're misguided. Clearly they're delusional. And our prayers should be with them. We have to pray for anyone wounded by this, anyone who's been sucked up in this great deception. If the court does overturn Roe in the Dobbs case, right, then you're going to see a real abortion divide in the country. We're already seeing it after the Texan abortion law passed, right? You saw how crazy everybody went after what happened in the state of Texas. The New York governor, a Catholic, by the way, she calls herself Catholic, Kathy Hochul. She took over Cuomo's position, she told women in Texas, which are about 1,800 miles away from the great empire state and from the capital of Albany. Yeah, she's Catholic, yeah, Patrick. She's Patrick. My call screener is asking me, sure she's Catholic? No, she's Catholic. She calls herself Catholic. She's invited them to come to New York to get abortions. She told NBC this, right? For women in Texas, they just need to know, we will help you find a way to New York. And we're right now looking intensely to find what resources we can bring to the table to help you have safe transportation here, let you know that there are providers who will assist you at this time of your need. As I said, we are living in a time of great evil, a time of great deception. You know, we're in a battle for good versus evil. And clearly, you can see how sick, how twisted, how deceived so many are. I'm joined right now by Rick Garnett. He's joining me today. He's a brilliant professor of law at the University of Notre Dame School of Law. And I hope you'll follow him. He's got a great Twitter handle, at Rick Garnett. That's Garnett, I should say, G-A-R-N-E-T-T is the last name. That's how you spell it. And it's good to have him with us today. Professor, thanks for your time. Always good to talk to you.
Yeah, you too. Thanks for having me on.
You know, I hear these stories. They actually sadden me intensely. They sicken me. So sad. Professor Robert George, one of my favorites, he's such a brilliant intellect from Princeton. He's predicted that the court will overturn Roe. He wrote a piece recently, I think it's called Roe Will Go, and he says it's going to overturn it 6-3. Your thoughts on his prediction and all that we're seeing unfold right now?
Yeah, well, you know, with all due respect to my good friend Robbie, I published a piece predicting that a couple weeks before he did. So I
love
it.
Good for you. Then you get props. You get the credit.
Yeah, you know, I agree with Professor George on this. I know that there are some who are anxious that, you know, as happened back in the early 90s with the Casey decision, that some justices who we thought would support correct constitutional interpretation didn't, that's going to happen again. And, you know, I'm just cautiously optimistic, but still optimistic that all the data we have about the current justices suggests, I think, pretty strongly that they will return this issue to the state legislatures, to legislatures generally, and that they'll just undo the error of Roe, which is now almost 50 years old. And they'll do it notwithstanding amicus briefs filed by athletes or celebrities or corporations and so on. I guess I should disclose, I filed a brief too, but I was on the other side. And I've been filing briefs for a long time, and my own view is that the justices aren't excessively moved by amicus briefs. Right. In this case, it really is a question of interpretive methodology, not to throw out too many big words. And at least six of the justices have pretty clearly embraced an approach to the Constitution under which, to quote Robert George, Roe has to go.
I love it. So, you know, I know you've read some of these amicus briefs, too, opposing overturning Roe.
Yeah.
And you said something, I love the phrase you use. You called them an army of wokeness. Expand on that. What do you mean by that when you said that there's an army of wokeness?
Well, I think a lot of the briefs that were filed were, they didn't even make a pretense of making legal arguments or talking about what the law is. They were clearly about little more than signaling one's correct position on this policy question. So a lot of corporations, they want to be able to say to the world, hey, we are registering that we are one of the institutions with the correct view. and that's becoming increasingly common, unfortunately, in our constitutional culture, that we have these polarizations and these divides, and more you're seeing companies and, again, athletes and sports leagues and sports teams feeling the need to kind of advertise their virtue, not with the strength of their legal arguments. They don't have any clue what their legal arguments are, but just with registering that, hey, we're on the side of, the progressive end of this issue. And it's a shame. I mean, maybe it's good advertising, but it's a shame that it's thought to be necessary. Why can't we just go buy coffee without having to worry about which side of the abortion question the CEO of the coffee company is on? But something you said in the setup kind of indicated an interesting shift here. Back in 2007 and 2008, there was a proposal in Congress that was also going to codify Roe as federal law, so that even if it went away, but it had a different name. They called it the Freedom of Choice Act, which was more sort of clear about what was going on, in the sense it was clearly connected to abortion. And now, as you pointed out, this rebranded version of the same law, actually it's a more extreme version, the new vocabulary, the new euphemism, is to sort of try to make people think it's not about abortion at all, but really that's all it's about.
No, it's so true. Doctor, stay with me. I'm going to take a short pause. When we come back, I want your insight on what looms for the future. If Roe is overturned, the political fallout, I mean, we're seeing states pitted against states right now, and what this will mean for the nation. We'll also take your calls. I only have Dr. Garnett just for a few minutes on the other side, so if you got a question, an insight, or you want to join the conversation, you can dial in right now. It's 888-914-9149. We'll be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
All things current. This is the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, trying to give you a quick update on all that's unfolding right now for the fight for life in our country. And I'm telling you what, it is ratcheting up. It is ratcheting up. You know, when that Texas abortion law passed, other states like New York went kind of wild over. That's a state that loves to champion abortion. We've seen that in the past. The so-called Catholic governor there, Kathy Hochul, was even looking for ways to transport women from Texas to New York. Let's pray for her. Let's pray for our public officials. But we're going to see more of this from other states. In fact, Maggie's getting a piece of news that just came across her radar. Maggie, why don't you open your mic and share what's now being reported? This is pretty big news.
Yeah, as of just within the last hour, LifeNews.com published an article saying that a Florida legislator has introduced a heartbeat bill that would ban abortions. It's a copycat of Texas's legislation. Yeah,
I love it. We're going to see a lot more of that. My guest today, and we'll talk about what we're now seeing, is Professor Rick Garnett. Garnett, I should say. I was going to call him Garnett. Professor Rick Garnett. It's good to have you with me, Professor. He hails from Notre Dame School of Law, and let's pick up on that point. You know, if Roe is overturned, there will be political fallout. We've seen backlash against Texas for their laws, even against Justice Kavanaugh, when protesters showed up at his house. How much division do you see, if any, that will happen, like we're seeing right now between New York and Texas? What's going to happen to the country, to states, to the governors, et cetera?
Well, some of this depends on how well we do at educating people about how extreme America's current abortion regime is. We have the most permissive abortion regime in the Western world, except unfortunately, I think, for Ireland these days. But most Americans, even who identify as pro-choice, they are under the impression that abortion is regulated after viability, that it's not engaged in for purposes of targeting disabled children or sex-selective abortion. Americans are often surprised when you tell them how extreme Roe versus Wade is, that really, under Roe, abortion is constitutionally protected, at least in some circumstances, to the moment before birth. When people hear that, they're surprised. If we can remind people that overturning Roe, it doesn't outlaw abortion. That's not how Supreme Court cases work. It doesn't end it. Unfortunately, for those of us who are pro-life, it will continue in a lot of these states. What will happen if Roe is overturned, and I think it will be, is that the energy shifts to legislatures and it shifts to state courts. And so, in a sense, the fight will become all the more intense because pro-life folks will have to be litigating for correct interpretations of state constitutional law. They'll have to be fighting in state legislatures. But we'll see lots of states do what New York and Virginia have done recently, enacting very extremely permissive abortion regimes. And you'll probably see, depending on what happens in Congress with the upcoming elections, an effort to codify a very permissive Roe regime and impose it nationwide. There's an irony here, is that a lot of political scientists whose judgment I trust tell me that it could well be that overturning Roe is bad for the Republican Party. Now, of course, that shouldn't be the major concern for those of us who are pro-life. But it will trigger a significant backlash, a significant corporate backlash. There'll be calls to pack the court. We have to be prepared for that. But none of that changes the correct answer to the moral question. Mm-hmm. And in my view, it doesn't change the correct answer to the legal question either.
I couldn't agree with you more. This Women's Health Protection Act that's going to be voted on, it's going to probably pass the House. There's a Democratic majority there. But what happens in the Senate? How much of that relies on the Senate keeping the filibuster in place? What do you see happening there?
Yeah, I think it's as drafted now. It's so extreme that I'd be surprised if it could pass the Senate, at least so long as there is a filibuster. I don't think it would be just one senator who might balk. I mean, as drafted, this new law would kind of run roughshod over the abortion laws of a lot of blue states too.
Oh,
I mean, and there are blue states or states that have Democratic senators that do regulate abortion after viability and do require things like parental notice and waiting periods and so on. And this new act, and in addition, the new act would call for public funding. So it probably is, this is designed as kind of a, maybe stunt is too cynical of a word, but it's a public relations tool to kind of get people riled up in preparation for the Dobbs oral arguments.
Well, Professor, always good to talk to you. I'm grateful for all that you do and for the clarity you're able to bring. If people want to follow you, the best way to do that, I'm assuming, is Twitter. Do you want to give out your handle?
Well, just so with the caveat that it's not good for anybody's soul to be on Twitter, it's at
True.
Rick Garnett.
I love it. At Rick Garnett. All right.
Yep.
That's perfect. Sounds great. Hey, Professor, thanks. We will catch up again, okay? Appreciate you making
Sounds
time
good.
For
Thank
me.
You.
Thank you.
Take
care. Yeah, follow him on Twitter. You'll be glad you did. I love what he had to say. Yeah, it's not good for your soul. It's probably true. It is a place, you know, to evangelize. It is a place to connect. And you can follow us, too, at Drew Mariani Show. That's our show account. Maggie is keeping that handle and that the Twitter account pretty busy. You can follow me personally, too, at Drew Mariani. Love to have you there. And, of course, our Facebook page as well. Maggie, we only got a few moments left. You were just sharing with me as I was walking into the studio today a little bit of fun and good news.
Yeah. Well, it's just a powerful photo. I'm going to retweet it here on our Twitter page. I used to live in Nashville, so I still have Twitter accounts, like keeping an eye on what's going on in Nashville. So Fox Nashville posted yesterday a photo of football players who are taking a knee before a game because their coaches and teachers were instructed by the school to not lead students in prayers anymore. So the students themselves, the players themselves, decided to just take the knee and lead the prayer themselves. I just thought that was really cool and encouraging to see. And all the parents are standing around kind of having a circle of protection around the players.
I love it. I think most people, you know, are they. I think we all have wired in our heart the reality that there is a God. And I think people want to express that and they want to pray.
Yep.
And prayer is a big part of a lot of people's life. And it's unfortunately been stripped from our public institutions and from our schools. And from our football fields and from so many other places. It's really unfortunate. Summer is over. Did you know that? Today is, of course,
the first day of fall.
It's the first day of fall. Yes, finally. I love fall. What's your favorite season?
Oh, I got to say spring.
Is it really?
I love spring.
I kind of like fall. I do. I like fall. Summer's not bad. But today, of course, it's known as the autumnal equinox. Is that what it is here?
Yeah. Autumnal.
Autumnal equinox. And then what's the other one? The vernal? Is that the vernal or spring equinox?
Oh, geez, I don't know.
Yeah, that's the other one. I think that's the other one. But today, on this, say it again.
It's autumnal.
Autumnal. The autumnal equinox. It's actually, believe it or not, those are Latin words, you know, meaning the equinox is from a Latin word meaning night, I think, right? I think equal night is something, mm-hmm. That's what it means. And then we have roughly, 12 hours of night and 12 hours of day, 12 hours of darkness, 12 hours of light today, which is
beautiful.
Good. Soon the days will start getting short, and that's going to be a bummer because when we walk out of the studio here, it'll be dark, you know? That's always a bummer, you know? In the summer, the sun never goes down. It's late at night. When we leave here in the wintertime sometimes, I come in, the sun's out. I leave this box that I broadcast out of, you know? There's no windows where Maggie and I are. We walk out, it's like we entered another time zone. Anyway, enjoy your fall. It's the first day. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for letting me be part of your afternoon. I'm back every day at the same time. Tell others about the broadcast. Visit anything you might have missed. And pray for us, okay? We'll be doing the same for you.